Welcome to the Dellingpod with me, James Dellingpod, and I know I always say this, but I am so excited about this week's special guest. Her name is Vanessa Beeney. Vanessa, I know that you're the kind of investigative journalist they don't make anymore. You're kind of old school, you do your legwork, and you're not afraid. I think this is fair to say, isn't it? You're not afraid to make enemies. You're not afraid to tell it like it is.
That's very obvious. After a concerted smear attempt by, well, actually for the last 4 years, to be honest, from mainstream media.
I think it's safe to say that you're not mainstream media, right? Are you?
So I think it's safe to say I'm controversial. I think that's maybe the term you're looking for.
you are controversial. But you know, the terrible thing is, Vanessa, that I mentioned in some of our exchanges, I think I'm increasingly going your way. I mean, I'm quite far down the rabbit hole. And I think a lot of my contemporaries from the mainstream media, because as you know, I cut my teeth. I mean, I worked on the Telegraph for 10 years, and I was very much a, you know, mainstream media journalist. I wrote for proper newspapers and things. I think they're probably looking at me now and thinking, yeah, he used to be a good journalist, but then he started getting interested in all this kind of cranky stuff, like
conspiracy theorism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just tell me a bit about your journey, your journalistic journey. Because I'm absolutely rubbish at doing my research on my. I like to point the microphone or the camera and just go. So tell me about your journey.
Well, I mean, basically, most people have sort of that are following me have heard it. My father was probably one of the most iconic Arabists of his time. He was Middle East advisor to Ernest Bevin post-war. He was involved in many of the discussions over Palestine. He was a supporter of Palestine for the majority of his career. And so I grew up in that kind of environment. As a child, I spent a number of years in Egypt when he was posted there not during the Suez Crisis. I'm not quite that old, but later on in 67, during the Six-Day War. And then actually after his death in 2001, I inherited a number of his confidential papers and diaries, and I started to go through it. And at this time, I was not, you know, I wasn't a journalist. I was working in the corporate industry in the UK and in Europe. But I started to go through everything, and, you know, I have quite an analytical brain. I started to go through it, and I started to really get a bigger picture of what had been going on. And then I decided to make the journey to Gaza, Palestine, in 2012. Initially, actually, I went more as an activist. I went to work with an orphanage there. I entered, the first time I went, I entered illegally through the tunnels because I was spun from the Rafah crossing point in Egypt. Despite having all my papers in order, I wasn't allowed entry. So we entered through the underground tunnels. 2 days after we entered, Israel started the bombing campaign in 2012. So we were effectively stuck there. I mean, I wouldn't have abandoned them anyway, but we were there for those 2 weeks. I then went back in 2013 to try and set up some kind of nature center, to try and help the kids that are clearly suffering from PTSD, ADHD symptoms, because they're constantly living under this, they're living in an open air prison. And then for health reasons, I had to come back to France. But what sort of piqued my interest in 2013 was the fact that Israel bombed Damascus. I think it was in April 2013. And there was talk of it being a tactical nuke, etc., because of the size of the explosion. At that time, I interviewed a Hamas spokesperson who, let's say, sort of shocked me and put me on point a little bit, because he said, well, you know, Damascus has crossed Israel's red line by supplying arms to Hezbollah. Now, you know, we have to put this in context. Hezbollah has been probably the greatest nemesis of Israel with regards to Palestine, and the greatest supporter of the Palestinian cause. So for a high-ranking member of Hamas to actually tell me, well, yeah, it's perfectly normal for Israel to bomb Damascus, regardless of where your sympathies lie, this is a strange event. So this sort of pointed me more in the direction of Syria. And I then had to return back to France for health reasons. I went under treatment for cancer for about a year. And during that time, I was researching and looking at what was happening in Syria. And I was pretty horrified by what I was reading, what I was understanding about what was happening, that effectively this was another in a long line of regime change wars that were effectively being sponsored by my government in the UK, by the US, and by their allies, by Israel, by Turkey, by the Gulf states, etc. I went to Syria for the first time in 2016. I did actually try to enter prior to that, but getting a visa to Syria is notoriously difficult, particularly understandably during a war situation. I entered Syria the first time in 2016 as a member of the US peace delegation, which was set up by the US Peace Council to basically send a number of American activists and veterans, peace community activists to Syria to ascertain the truth. Of course, I've been retrospectively vilified for daring to assume that we could actually provide information that might bring peace to Syria and end the war and find some kind of diplomatic political resolution. But that's part of the vilification campaign against myself. And prior to that, of course, I'd started the investigation into an organization called the White Helmets. I think my first article was published in 2015 in August from memory. That, of course, had been triggered by the work of Corey Morningstar, who I know you're a great admirer of, who has many years investigated the role of the NGO complex, a so-called non-governmental organization, the majority of which, of course, are funded by governments to carry out their dirty work in prey nations. So she effectively triggered me to look deeper into this organization, and the rest is kind of history. So I don't have, you know, I fully admit I don't have the typical journalistic qualifications. I was a finalist for the Martha Gellhorn Prize in 2017. And that year, of course, it was won by the amazing acclaimed Robert Parry. So I feel a huge amount of pride in coming second to him. I was named by the National Council for the Training of Journalists as one of the most 238 trusted journalists in 2017. Mm-hmm. So, you know, although
Vanessa, I think people should be judged totally on their work. I think awards, they're neither here nor there. I mean, you know, for example, I don't know where you stand on the journalist Caroline Cadwallader, but she won the Norwell Prize and a lot of her journalism turns out to be pretty ropey. I mean, you know, if you're going to give the Orwell Prize to anyone, give it to me or give it to you or give it to somebody. Now, the interesting thing is, Vanessa, look, I'm kind of on some issues. I'm on the other side of you. I'm rampantly pro-Israel for better or worse. I think Hezbollah are the baddies. I think Hamas are a terrorist organization. But I know that you and I have a lot in common on a lot of things, which is weird. Now, the White Helmet story, I've read some of your stuff on this, and here's what I think we have in common, one of the big things we have in common. Oh, you're freezing there because you're in. No, you're moving now. I thought it might be your because you're in. I ought to tell.
I do have the heater here.
you're in Damascus, and you only get rationed electricity, which we'll come into in a minute. Here's what I'm beginning to discover, Vanessa, we're totally on side here. That there are certain things in the world which everyone pretty much assumes to be so, which are not so. And these things which people assume to be so are relayed constantly in the media as though they're, nobody rings me at this time of morning. I don't know how impertinent, can I just say? Really impertinent to ring me at 8:15 in the morning.
It's probably the BBC. Stop talking to her.
No, I hate Vanessa. I consider that there are a few organisations I would consider more dangerous than Hamas or Hezbollah, but the BBC would definitely be on that list.
Yeah.
I hate the BBC. I think they are absolutely...
We have that in common.
They are Satan. We have... Oh, yeah, yeah. We're going to... but I imagine... I can just imagine some of my people who... You know, my Israeli fans who like, yeah, he's really pro-Israel. Why are you talking to this evil?
I think this is a really important point, because what has happened in media discourse and even in public discourse is the slamming down of differing views, right? No longer allowed to have an informed, sensible, grown-up debate. And this has been my point for a long time. You know, talking to someone like you, in the same way, my followers are going to be going, what the hell? Like, you're talking to someone who supports this.
Yes.
But the fact is, if we don't have some kind of civilized discourse, then it remains in these two kind of reductionist separated camps. And there's never going to be any solution found. And so therefore, I think because we can talk in a civilized way, there's a chance that each side can potentially educate itself and have a greater understanding. And that's my point.
Yes.
So thank you
for
doing this.
No, thank you for coming on this. Thank you for talking to me. I am interested in this white helmet story because I remember there was a period where you can probably tell me exactly when it was, about 2 or 3 years ago, when the white helmets were all over the place. They were saving the world. They were I think there was a documentary about them, wasn't there, that won a prize at Cannes or somewhere.
It won the Oscar.
It won the Oscar. Yeah. That's right. And I know that wasn't the whole truth. So give me a sort of potted version of the white helmet story.
Oh God, I love it when anyone ever says, "Give me a potted version." It's fine. I can do it. It's fine.
In fact, let me ask you a question first. Helmets belong to a particular faction, don't they?
That's interesting. That's interesting that's your understanding of it, because No, it's interesting because this demonstrates to me that actually public consensus is coming on board with the fact that they are embedded with Al-Qaeda. And the armed groups in Syria, operating in Syria, even those that originated from Syrian factions, but Syrian factions of the Muslim Brotherhood, which of course was effectively created by Great Britain in Egypt in order to serve as a battering ram for the imperialist policies globally. And in Syria, it's been no different. There has been a series of externally fomented interventions with the use of the Muslim Brotherhood as their instrument of power or their instrument of destabilization. And effectively, this war against Syria is really no different. So those, let's say, indigenous armed groups, which consist of Muslim Brotherhood, have been power multiplied by Al-Qaeda, by ISIS, by a number of other, because Al-Qaeda and ISIS were one group, effectively, originally, then they split. I tend to see these terrorist armed groups as a mafia organization. They fight among themselves for money, for influence, for power, for territory, but effectively the ideology the overarching ideology is very much the same for all of them, including the so-called moderate opposition, the Free Syrian Army, that group that you heard about when the so-called Arab Spring started in Syria, which of course was an externally fomented uprising against a recalcitrant government that was not coming into line. And the white helmets are effectively embedded only with the armed groups, and the armed groups are dominated by Al-Qaeda. As Brett McGurk, the CENTCOM sort of head of operations, stated recently, Idlib, for example, which is the last stronghold of the armed groups inside Syria, is the largest Al-Qaeda haven since 9/11. And so therefore, yes, the White Helmets were created in 2013. Although they came from operatives inside Syria, so-called volunteers inside Syria, they were effectively founded and trained by British military intelligence with British government funding and US funding, Qatari funding, Saudi, et cetera, but in Turkey and in Jordan. And in Jordan, it's recently been shown that the White Helmet Training Center there was shared with the Armed Group Training Center. So basically, they were working hand in glove with the armed groups. Now, this group was founded, let's say, at a point where the media, the direct media propaganda was starting to collapse. People were starting to see, well, hold on a minute. You know, I've actually made a film called The Veto, which covers all of the early fabrications. Because what happened then, sorry, I'm on a bit of a roll, but what happened then was external influences like Avaaz, the petition site that most people know is sort of putting online petitions. They established a platform, an internet platform called Bambuser. This is all documented. This is all evidence, by the way. And basically, this platform, Bambuser, was the central hub for all of these largely British-trained so-called citizen journalists and activists, etc., to feed their news stories, but into this central hub. And then from this hub, CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, Al Arabi would take the story and use it on their live section news reports on Syria. But there's one major problem with this. The number of these reports that were fabricated, and when they uploaded these reports, they forgot to cut out the beginning when they were staging the event. And so they uploaded the entire report. So when CNN took a section of the report, which showed incoming bombs or explosions or shootings, etc., they omitted the before and after, when they were staging and when they were laughing and clearing up or you know, celebrating the success of their little staged event, right? Yeah. So what I managed to do with with a Syrian documentary maker here was to go through all of the Bambuser reports and to compile them into a documentary, which shows exactly, and actually there's a report from Channel 4 in the Veto, which shows them openly saying, yeah, well, you know, for this clip, he just burned a few tires down below. And they show him giggling afterwards and saying, yeah, but, you know, what do I have to do? I have to influence the media to get support for our cause, right? So this is effectively intelligence predominantly was responsible for. Now, a recent leak of British government documents, I think in September of this year, there's a report at Grey Zone on this, and it's been admitted by Dominic Grubb that these documents are credible, but of course he's claiming they were hacked by Russia and it was Russia that stole them. In fact, it was an anonymous group that put it out on the internet for our education. But within those documents, and there's a very good article at Grey Zone, which I recommend to everyone to read, it demonstrates basically that it was the UK Foreign Office funding sort of intelligence cutout organizations like BASMA, like Analysis, Research and Knowledge, Albany, Inkerstrat, and we'll come back to Inkerstrat later, to expend enormous amounts of cash, energy, etc., in funding media relations for the brutal armed groups, which included Al-Qaeda. As I've shown, it's very hard to disentangle Al-Qaeda from Free Syrian Army, Ar-Rasham, all of these other splinter groups, right? And effectively, the British government was providing PR on an absolutely massive scale. I mean, you have people also like Khan Ross, who you probably know as a whistleblower from Iraq. He featured in John Pilger's The War You Don't See. But he later set up the Independent Diplomat. Now, the Independent Diplomat was tasked and is funded by the British government to provide a platform for euphemistically named Syrian opposition. So this entire operation of effectively whitewashing, iconizing the Syrian opposition, which are effectively armed groups, was funded and created by the British government, by the UK Foreign Office. It was funded through the Conflict Stability and Security Fund, largely. And the White Helmets were a spin-out from this operation, ARC, Analysis, Research and Knowledge, basically was responsible for the creation of the White Helmets, as I said, in Turkey and Jordan. And then its continued promotional activity. So you can include in that the Oscar-winning movie. You can include, and I've written all about this also, the Oscar-nominated movie, Last Men in Aleppo. All of the PR was effectively done by the British government through their various outreach agents and organizations and NGOs to create this humanitarian legend that effectively then was tasked with providing the propaganda to criminalize the Syrian government. And of course, we include within that the chemical weapon narratives, because those effectively really took impetus after the creation of the White Helmets. Of course, the first major one, not the first major one in Syria, because Syrian army were attacked with chemical weapons in March 2013 in Khan al-Asl, close to Aleppo. But of course, the UN did nothing until 2013. And the day the UN inspectors landed in Damascus, suddenly we have a chemical attack in eastern Ghouta, which of course distracts them from the terrorist use of chemical weapons in Khan al-Asl in March of the same year.
Oh, Vanessa.
Am I breaking?
We are so far down the rabbit hole, and I'm just loving it. But I'm just gonna have to just backtrack.
Yeah, step in.
So I think this is quite important, and I everything you make, I've read some of this stuff before, but you know, it's a while back. I mean, one absorbs so much information, and then just it goes out again. So to backtrack, in around 2013, there were loads of stories about these heroes, the White Helmets, who were just identifiable by their distinctive white helmets, who would go into burning buildings and rescue kids, and you'd see the kids with dust on their face, and you'd see the and one of the first ways I noticed that this was not necessarily trustworthy was when you saw the same actor playing the same role in supposedly different scenarios, the same sort of grievously wounded man or the same child. I think that went on a bit. And it's what I was following. Do you know Thomas Victor on Twitter? He's a this is another rabbit hole thing. Thomas Victor, or Victor, it's spelled with a W. I don't know whether it's his real name. It's the world's greatest expert on World War I flamethrowers. And he uses his skills at analysing photographs and maps and things to put together. And he talks about Pallywood productions, about because there's a lot of this that goes on in Gaza and the West Bank, isn't there? There's that they create these sort of propaganda videos and then they stage them. So I was familiar with the concept of these videos. So the white helmets were all over the shop. They were all over the newspapers. Respectable journalists were writing pieces in their praise, because I think people were desperate for some good news to come out of Syria. And this fitted the mainstream media's desire for a positive story to come out of Syria. But what you're telling me is that essentially all the different militant factions, all the kind of Islamist factions, are really sort of branches of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. And that essentially the UK Foreign Office, and probably it was, I imagine, the US government as well, I don't know.
Yeah,
for sure. Certainly the UK Foreign Office, in coordination with Avaaz, which Avaaz is a kind of hard left organization, hasn't it got connections with George Soros?
Or not? Yes, possibly. Yes, I think it does. I think it does. Certainly,
but anyway,
through a number of other probably convoluted connections. Yes, it does.
Just correct me at any point if I'm wrong. But I think this is just so the Foreign Office was funding these and even training these people. I mean, were we giving them military training or technology or?
Well, as I said, I mean, in Jordan, there was a recent report that came out, and a member of parliament in Jordan, Tarek Khoury, I think his name is, I spoke to him last year. He has publicly called for the white helmets that remain in Jordan, because, as you know, they were evacuated by Israel, but under the auspices of Canada, actually, was the main behind their evacuation in 2018, from memory. I lose track of years at the moment. There are a number of white helmets that have not been resettled outside, including in the UK, in Canada, in Germany, I think, that are still in Jordan. And he's called for their extradition back to Syria to stand trial as terrorists.
Because they were, basically.
Effectively. The role between, I mean, you talk about the white helmets, one interesting story, and of course, you know, what sort of absolutely confounds my detractors is the fact that I've spent, not only myself, Eva Bartlett, another journalist who's worked independently inside Syria alongside myself, but we have effectively worked on the ground in Syria, in the areas where the white helmets occupied, obviously after liberation, because I don't intend to enter areas, unlike many of the mainstream journalists for The Guardian and so on, seem to be able to rub shoulders quite happily with these armed groups. One can assume quite safely that's because the armed groups perceive them as friends and as supporters of their cause. And I will give another example of that. Now, myself, when I entered East Aleppo in December 2016, and I was literally following on the heels of the Syrian army as they liberated. Actually, it wasn't so much the Syrian army in East Aleppo. This is another thing that most people are not aware of. The group that actually liberated East Aleppo was Liwa al-Quds, which is the Palestinian Brigade inside Syria. And the areas of East Aleppo that they were liberating were effectively previously their homes before they were invaded by the Tawhid Brigade in 2012, which was Turkish backed, because Turkey, of course, as part of Erdogan's neo-Ottoman empire aspirations, perceived the annexation of Aleppo and certain areas in Syria as his right. And of course, carried out enormous amounts of industrial theft via his terrorist proxies that invaded East Aleppo. Entire industrial areas were dismantled, taken to Turkey and re-established there. We can also go further into that. But when I entered these areas and spoke directly with civilians who had lived under the occupation of the armed groups dominated by Al-Qaeda and the White Helmets, when I spoke to all of them and I said, do you know the White Helmets? They all looked at me sort of completely puzzled. And then when I said to them, you know, the civil defense, they went, oh, yeah, of course, Al-Qaeda civil defense, Nusra Front civil defense. You know, and So this demonstrated to me what I'd been told by Syrian Arab Red Crescent, that the White Helmets didn't operate as humanitarians inside East Aleppo. Effectively, what they did, they were armed group members. When there was a need to produce a little kind of bit of footage, you know, for CNN, for BBC, for Channel 4, they would put on the uniforms and the footage would be filmed. I mean, I was also told this by civilians there that, yes, they would take dead bodies of children from other areas. They would take it to somewhere where they would claim there had been an attack, and they would use the bodies from that had been killed in the battles in other areas. You know, and this was a story that was repeated to me in Dara, in Kronetra, in Ghouta, in Homs, in all the areas where this group operated, and of course now in Idlib. Now, I understand, like, to some of your audience, this is just going to sound like crazy stuff, right?
Crazy, yeah.
But let's go back. You know, we need to remember the Kuwaiti incubator story. We need to remember the Benghazi rape story. We need to remember the non-existent weapons of mass destruction. You know, we need to remember the extent to which imperialist governments like our own, like the British government, like the US government, are capable. And let's look at COVID-19. I mean, if we're talking at major fabrication of an event in order to subjugate populations, let's look at COVID-19, where in reality, what I do is I look at the Syrian conflict and how it has been manipulated and orchestrated. And then I look at COVID-19 and the hybrid war strategy. So this includes all the non-military wars that are waged against a target nation. So the media war, the economic wars, etc., the propaganda wars are now being waged against us. So actually the parallels are, as you say, down the bunny hole. The parallels are very, very important here.
I'm really glad you said that, Vanessa, because I think a lot of us started out this year going la 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 la, the world is as we always thought it was, and suddenly this year we've woken up to the fact that government is not your friend. Government lies to you on without compunction. Government, there is a shadowy elite out there which has no interest in the lives of ordinary people except as sort of peons for whatever they want us to do. And you're right. I would never have believed that such a thing as COVID-19 would be possible. And when I talk about COVID-19, I don't mean the kind of the bad cold, the probably, you know, like a bad case of flu if you're unlucky. I don't mean that. I mean the government reaction. So, but yeah, I wish I had you for 5 hours, because actually there's so much we can talk about. I suddenly realized as we were talking about the White Helmets that there's a question, more basic question I ought to, which I come to in a minute. But first, let me ask you, why is the Foreign Office, the UK Foreign Office, supporting these terrorist groups? Well, what are they doing effectively teaming up with Al-Qaeda to make propaganda videos? How does that work? What's the objective? What's the claimed objective?
The claimed objective, of course, is the usual R2P, responsibility to protect, humanitarian pretext for war. Let's make peace by dropping bombs and so on. Well, I mean, this was a philosophy or an ideology established in order to give humanitarian pretext for these military interventions. Now, of course, in Iraq, it was a direct military intervention, and there were a large number of casualties among UK, US troops, more US troops, I think. And so effectively, what they saw in Syria was an opportunity to start using proxies, to start destabilizing by proxy. Now, if we go back to the Bush-Blair communications around 2003, which were exposed in the Chilcot report into the dodgy dossier of weapons of mass destruction, which of course led to the deaths of millions of Iraqis, the use of depleted uranium and the ongoing cost for Iraqis of what was effectively a neo-colonialist project that has virtually destroyed the country, certainly economically, but also from a perspective of health.
And which also created the whole problems that we've got. I mean, they created ISIS, didn't they? ISIS emerged from the ruins of allied of British American policy in Iraq.
Yeah, effectively. But you know, you need to remember, I mean, I don't like to separate the creation of ISIS from the US coalition and intelligence operations. I mean, for example, in March this year, an SAS operative was airlifted out of southern Syria because he'd been injured in an IED explosion. So, you know, our question to the British government, what the hell is an SAS officer? And of course, we know that there's more than one doing in southern Syria that is now relatively stable. It's now back under the control of the government. People are rebuilding, people are trying to restore, etc. And also, the American base at Al-Tanf, which is to the southeast of Syria, is right next door to Rukban refugee camp, which is another tool used in the humanitarian lexicon by the US coalition. But Rukban is effectively, and this is based on evidence from people that have managed to get out of Rukban, is effectively a training center for ISIS and other extremist groups being funded by America, extensively armed with weapons through Jordan, supplied by Britain, America, etc. Much of the equipment, of course, is being supplied to the White Helmets from Britain and Europe, right, and is coming in through the Turkish borders and the Jordanian borders. Huge amounts of money have been raised, not only by the Foreign Office. I mean, the White Helmets have, to give you an idea, the White Helmets have an operating budget. I will get back to your question, have an operating budget of $35 million a year. The real Syria Civil Defense, which was established in Syria in 1953, it's the only recognized civil defense organization in Syria by the International Civil Defense Organization in Geneva, operates on a budget of $15,000, if it's lucky, if it's lucky. And it is servicing 85% of Syria, which is now back under the control of the state. Therefore, if we go back to the Bush-Blair communiques, which is where I started this ramble, sorry, I tend to do this. Blair and Bush, very early on in 2003, were talking about the potential of creating a different relationship with Assad. They saw at this stage an opportunity, as they saw it. He was British educated, he was an ophthalmologist, educated in the UK, spent extensive time in the UK, married to someone, I think his wife was actually born in the UK. But certainly both of them were UK based. So they saw this basically as an opportunity to influence, to gain influence inside Syria through Assad. So for the next few years, Assad was courted. Effectively, right. I mean, Blair offered him a knighthood, a number of very positive articles were written about him. Of course, he was. I mean, if you speak to Peter Ford, who was British ambassador between 2003 and 2006, when I spoke to him, he said to me, no, very clearly, Assad was a reformer. He was there. He was trying to reform a system which was basically established underneath his father, Hafez al-Assad, for obviously...
Yes, who was a tyrant, wasn't he? Hafez was a pretty scary...
The Syrian people would disagree with you because, of course, the tyrant accusation comes from, as I said, the uprising which was funded externally and fomented externally by the UK and the US, which began in the 70s to destabilize the Syrian government using the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, everybody knows about the so-called Hamas massacre. Hamas is to the northwest of Damascus. And in reality, but very few people know about the campaign of civilian massacres, suicide bombs, attacks on Hafez al-Assad himself, the massacre at the cadet college in Aleppo carried out by Muslim Brotherhood, massacring Alawites, cadets refused to join.
So Hafez al-Assad was an Alawite, which is a minority in Syria, but they were the kind of the ruling class from about what, 1950 or something? When did he take power?
You know, the entire sectarian narrative, the Alawites are a minority. The majority of the money in Syria actually lies, if we're going to go down this route, the majority of the money in Syria lies with the Sunni factions, with the Sunni families. So this entire construct of you know, why this war happened and so on is in my view erroneous. This was not a civil war. It was not a sectarian war initially, because actually one thing Syria prides itself on is the secular fabric of its society, right? And most people, all people here, actually, the question is never asked if you are Muslim or Christian or Shia or Alawite. And you have to also remember that one of the biggest targets during this war is the expulsion of Christians from Syria and from the region. And that is an ongoing campaign, because that is a major part of the destabilization. If you remove the Christian presence, you then are left with a Muslim sectarian divide. And of course, the plan behind the Syria destabilization would have also have been the partitioning of Syria into sectarian divided states that would continue warring against each other and would maintain this stabilization and weakening of this state. But if we go back to why this serves Britain as it always has done. I mean, you know, if we go back into Britain's imperialist history, of course, it has a history of division. It has a history. If we look at Kashmir, if we look at the partitioning, the Sykes-Picot agreement, etc., etc., we see this desire to break countries down into sectarian statelets that can then be better controlled. And of course, then we have to look at the resource plundering that comes from many of these wars. Syria is a relatively oil-rich nation. It was about to, before this war started, it was furthering economic relations with China, for example, the Five Seas Project. The Belt and Road Initiative, trade relations with Iran and Russia. So effectively, Syria, whatever your views are in this scenario, Syria was pivotal to what was a pivot towards the east. And this is an to the US supremacy, to global Britain. Let's not pretend that Britain doesn't have pretensions to expand its empire again. We're seeing it in Yemen. It's taken back control of Aden after it was kicked out in the 1930s, from memory, 37.
Do you think, sorry to pause you there for a moment, because there are so many directions we could go in.
No, sorry.
Do you think the Foreign Office is to some degree a rogue organisation? Do you think it operates sort of independently of the... Because I'm not sure that most British...
Politicians
would even be interested in this stuff. That it seems like these, like the Foreign Office, is dragging it in a particular direction, or is that wrong?
No, it's an interesting question. I'm not sure I can conclusively answer it. What I would say, of course, is the Foreign Office, in my opinion, is largely influenced by intelligence operations. So it's largely influenced by MI6. And if you look at the creation, as I said, of this entire kind of media public relations, and I mean, it's massive. Let's just look at Incostrat. 1,600 international journalists were working with Incostrat at one point. The number of citizen journalists that were created by these outreach organizations inside Syria to provide the narratives that would corroborate British foreign policy. And of course, if we're talking about British foreign policy, of course, that brings us to the chemical attacks dossier, which I equate to the weapons of mass destruction, dodgy dossier. If we come forward
I'm just thinking, I interrupted you at a key point in the story where you were telling me that, Hafez al-Assad was the, let's call him the autocratic leader of, he was a uniting force. He kept Syria stable with his Ba'ath party for many years. His son, an ophthalmologist, inherits the presidency and married to a pretty English woman.
Super and intelligent.
Initially,
super intelligent. Super intelligent. If you've ever watched any of her interviews, she's astounding.
I'd like to meet her. Bush, George W. Bush and Tony Blair caught Assad initially, thinking that he's going to be their placeman in the region. And then they suddenly decide to turn on him. Why do they turn on him?
Well, they basically turned on him because they realized that actually he wasn't going to come into line. Now, first of all, he refused to relinquish his Palestinian rights issue. Of course, Syria took in many of the Palestinian refugees after 1948 and was one of the few countries in the region to actually give them residency. And equal rights to Syrian citizens. So that was number one. Number two, he used to his partnership with Iran. And of course, again, I know we're on opposite sides on this, but of course, Israel's greatest perceived threat in the region is Iran and Hezbollah. And effectively, Assad refused to relinquish his partnership or relationship with Hezbollah and Iran.
Iran is committed to the destruction of Israel. So I mean, you can see why.
Okay, let's. We'll be here all
okay,
morning.
We won't go there. This is.
Come on, what?
Vanessa, this is the craziest. I think this is about the craziest vidcast I've done, and also about the most exciting. Because I'm thinking, my head is exploding. I'm thinking there is so much, you know, some serious shit. There is no question. And although we disagree on some issues, I genuinely think you have some insights into the Syrian conflict, which we were fed propaganda. We were, you know, I remember, for example, David Cameron getting really upset on behalf of his wife Sam Cam, who thought she understood the situation in Syria and was absolutely determined that Britain should go in and bomb Syria. And I remember this vote, and I remember writing pieces against this, saying it's absolutely ridiculous that we should be bombing Syria. You know, who are we bombing here? It's not this political entity with which we're at war. It's a series of competing interests, and why are we taking one side? So I understand that side of things, and I understand Peter Hitchens
has been doing an amazing job about the OPCW situation, and I mean that's a very important point to cover. Actually,
I think this is a kind of anchoring issue for you, for all those people who think, hang on, Vanessa Bailey is this kind of loon who lives in, you know. You and Peter Hitchens, who is a rigorous journalist, are in agreement that there was a fake chemical attack. Is that right? Effectively,
certainly aspects. Yeah, aspects of the attack were staged. The hospital scenes were staged. Even a BBC producer, Riem Dalati, tweeted out about this, saying that after 6 months of investigation, he's convinced that the hospital scenes at Douma in April 2018 was staged. Now, of course, actually, I was on the ground. Can I just, sorry, just very quickly rewind to the fact that also Assad then refused the American-backed Qatari-Turkey oil pipeline in favor of the Iranian pipeline, which was backed by Russia. Now, that was the big no-no for Britain and for America.
Because Russia and Iran, like two of our stated enemies, or
the new Cold War and et cetera, and then the Israeli nemesis Iran and so on. So this was a complete no-no for Britain, because of course Britain is a staunch defender of Israel, as is the America. So drawing a line under that was why effectively, in my view, Britain came in. Of course, there is a question of resources, it's a question of trade, et cetera, protect, blah, blah, blah. But those are the main reasons. But if we, OPCW, what were we talking about?
We were talking about, you see, this is the problem. We're going to need,
I know.
I think what we're going to need to do is edit this and sort of move things around, because we've been hopping and skipping. I hope at the very least what we've achieved is to trigger some thoughts in people, and you know, people will be able to pick up little gobbets of information from this. We're never going to get a coherent analysis, but I think Duma was this place which was allegedly subject of a chemical attack, wasn't it, by the evil Assad regime, according to the narrative. And it wasn't so, was it? But yeah, this was being given as the reason why Assad had crossed the line in the sand, or whatever it was, and therefore had to be punished for something he hadn't actually done. Is that right?
Yeah, effectively. And I mean, I was in Damascus at the time of the alleged attack. And again, you know, the insights that you can gain by being on the ground are incomparable to BBC journalists sat in London calling Jaish al-Islam or Al-Qaeda affiliates and getting their version of the facts, which of course are clearly going to be biased towards terrorist agendas. Effectively, I was in Damascus the day before the attack, and this is quite an interesting little anecdote. I had gone on, I'm always accused of going on government-organized tours. I consistently point out to people that when you're in the war zone, I'm quite grateful for government-assisted tours where I have a couple of soldiers with me in case the terrorists pop out, as they did during one of my trips in Aleppo. Actually, we'd literally walked past terrorists still housed in the basement of an area that had literally just been liberated. As we walked past, the soldiers received a call and shot down there to find them. So this happens. So I'm actually very grateful that the Syrian army and the government take care of, you know, take responsibility for my protection in these areas, as they do for The Guardian, Channel 4, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, we'd gone on this tour of areas that had very recently been liberated. And with me on that particular trip was Frederick Pleitgen of CNN. So we went together, right? And together we viewed a number of munitions factories that belonged to the armed groups, to the terrorist groups. We saw a number of what appeared to be chemical weapon manufacturing sites with a number of chemicals included in their manual showing them how to make chlorine grenades, etc. So all of this we viewed together. On the day of the attack, which was the next day, this news came in that there had been an alleged chemical attack as the Syrian army was closing in on Duma, which was one of the last occupied areas of eastern Ghouta. Now, Duma was occupied by one of the most savage, brutal groups in Syria, Jaish al-Islam. Jaish al-Islam, alongside Nusra Front al-Qaeda, in 2013 entered a town called Adra, which was largely inhabited by Alawite Muslims. They carried out a massacre. In one bakery, they took the workers at the bakery and they burned them alive in their own bread furnaces. So this is the armed group that was in control of Douma and who took the prisoners from Adra to Douma, kept them in an underground jail that I also visited, where they were kept largely, even women and children, in solitary confinement. They were tortured. They were used as lab rats, basically. They were experimented on with a number of drugs, with a number of chemical weapons. This is according to their testimony, by the way, which I have written up. And so this group is who was occupying Douma. It is also at this point worth pointing out that Jaish al-Islam's PR was paid for by the British government. So a group that is capable of burning people alive in bread furnaces, of torturing them, of keeping them in solitary confinement underground for 7 years, of murdering them, of using their bodies for staged events. This group had its PR produced for it by the British government through IncoStrat. Now, IncoStrat's co-founder was the third wife of James Le Mesurier, the British intelligence agent who created the White Helmets, who died in Istanbul in November 2019. Now, I know that is quite complex, but it's important for people to understand the connections between these groups and between the operatives behind these groups, right? This is a massive intelligence operation. So as the Syrian government was or the army was closing in on Douma to finally liberate it, and of course, we need to remember what would be exposed in Douma. First of all, that this group was being funded, or its PR was being funded by the British government. Second, the atrocities that it was carrying out, the connection, the close connection with the White Helmets. So what's the best thing to do? And if you map the Syrian conflict, you will see chemical weapon stories emerging every time the Syrian army advances towards an area that has been held for a long amount of time by these armed groups that are backed by the US and the UK coalition. So effectively, as they closed in, lo and behold, we have a chemical weapon attack, right? Now, an interesting aside here is that based on testimony that I received from on the ground, there had been another attempt at staging a chemical attack in a nearby area about a month before, but it had actually been derailed by civilians who had gone out on the streets to protest, and also to call for the Syrian army to come in. So they scotched it, right? And this is also demonstrated because the media started to run with the story and then suddenly dropped it, right? I've written this up. It's a really interesting story because clearly they meant to do it about a month before. And then when it came to the liberation of Douma, they thought, oh, okay, let's put something out, right? And so when Plytken of CNN stood in the street close to Douma and started to you know, give his little rhetoric about, well, it must be the Syrian government, etc., I messaged him on Twitter. I said, well, that's really interesting. Because you and I entered chemical weapon facilities, or what appeared to be chemical, but you don't mention any of that in your report. Is there a reason why? And he blocked me immediately, of course. You know, they don't stand up to scrutiny. And then, of course, that precipitated the unlawful bombing by the UK, France and US. And I was here when they bombed. And they effectively, if those bombs had hit target, Syrian civilians would have died in that onslaught. The Syrian air defenses did their job. Of course, they destroyed what they claimed was a chemical weapon facility in Baze, and of course even the OPCW said no, this was a cancer research center that they destroyed. You have to go back to 2013, of course, when the Syrian government destroyed all of its chemical weapon capability under the surveillance of both Russia and the OPCW. So, you know,
feeling angry and shocked, Vanessa. This hasn't been very well covered in the media. I mean, no. The fact that Peter Hitchens had to go to a safe house somewhere in a European capital, he described yesterday, I think, to get this information, and that there have been cover-ups, haven't there, by the inspectors and so on.
Not by the OPCW itself, but you have to understand that the OPCW is a heavily compromised organization.
So the OPCW, what does that stand for? OPCW?
Oh, God. Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons.
Okay, so they've got these sort of international inspectors who go in there, but actually, ultimately, they are dependent on their paymasters, who presumably are governments in the West, which essentially have a narrative of their own. They want to. I do remember feeling very strongly when there was this clamour. And it was in Parliament. There was a big debate about it, and in the
2013.
End,
2013. Yeah.
Yeah, and the government Parliament voted against. I think, is that right? I think.
And also you reminded me of a very important point. If you go back to that time, because that was 2013, and I remember we chatted about this on Twitter DM. if you go back to that time, look at the BBC. Very probably fabrication of a chemical weapon attack just before it went to the vote in Parliament, right? Now, that it was the BBC Panorama Saving Syria's Children, which was forensically investigated by independent researcher Robert Stewart. I highly recommend everyone to look at his work. He's had the backing of various high-level BBC-connected people who have agreed with him, right, including Sue Cook, who's another former BBC presenter who's coming out against their coverage of COVID-19. But she's also now looked at his reporting and said, my God, you know, if this is true, and if the BBC effectively staged an event to provide justification for bombing Syria, yeah. And, for, you know, So you're absolutely right to bring that up, because fast forward from 2013, that's why I call it the chemical weapon dodgy dossier, because this has effectively been the weapons of mass destruction in Syria, right? If we fast forward, I mean, it's been investigated by Scott Ritter, you know, former weapons inspector in Iraq. The questions are being raised by Jose Bustani, the former director general of the OPCW, who, of course, was kicked out by the Bush administration because he was getting too close to the truth on the lack of weapons of mass destruction. I mean, he was threatened. Right. His children were threatened at this point, right? He was told they knew where his children were. So he was clearly coerced into leaving the OPCW because he was honest. Now, fast forward, and Jose Bustani was invited by Russia when they had presidency of the UN Security Council to speak a couple of months ago. And he wanted to speak about defending transparency, robust investigation within the OPCW. So he was basically trying to save the credibility of the OPCW as an organization. He was basically, the UK and the US prevented him speaking at the UN Security Council. They found some, you know, ridiculous archaic rule which they could throw in there and prevent him appearing as a briefer to the Security Council. And as Nebensia said, whatever your view on Russia, you know, their diplomatic prowess in many ways is unquestionable. And Nebensia just said, you've brought the UN Security Council into disrepute. It's extraordinary. It has never happened in history that members of the Security Council have blocked the president of the Security Council from bringing up is extraordinary, because and this is very important. Effectively, what happened, and you're right, Peter Hitchens has been instrumental in putting this story out there, and in defense of, they don't like to be called whistleblowers as such, but they are experts and scientists who formed part of the OPCW team, who were horrified when the OPCW final report basically suppressed their information. It completely omitted their information, and it produced a report which retrospectively justified the UK, US and French unlawful bombing of civilian targets. I mean, you can't avoid that fact. If those missiles had hit in the areas they targeted, it would have killed civilians here in Syria.
Wow.
I mean, as I say, I was in Damascus when this bombing raid came in. I mean, typical Syrians, they were on the roof celebrating their air defense and so on. I mean, this is, you know, this is the strangeness of war sometimes. But at the same time, it was a concerted attack. Now, the OPCW report is clearly an attempt to produce a dodgy dossier to justify war crimes by the UK government under Theresa May, by the US under Trump and France. And so effectively what Hitchens is doing, and very bravely, I think, and huge kudos to him for having the integrity and the principle to do what journalists should do, which is, you know, this is, as he said, this was probably one of the most shocking stories of his career. And it is. Why is it so important? It's not actually only about Syria. The OPCW is now mandated by the countries that control it to attribute blame. Post-Duma, it was voted. Russia has not accepted that vote, or it considers it illegal. It is now mandated to attribute blame. The OPCW now becomes literally a nuclear weapon in the hands of, let's look at Biden's incoming administration, right? We have in Biden.
Pray God that he doesn't get in. I've still got my fingers crossed, Vanessa.
Yeah, but you know, it's terrifying. And so we have a situation where unless the OPCW is prepared to entertain complete transparency, in other words, to sit down and speak publicly to the inspectors that have clear justification for calling that, for saying that the report is corrupt, that it is lied by omission, that it has not included the scientific evidence and conclusions of the experts it employed to do that job. I mean, at the end of the day, these are not kind of, I know the media is desperately trying to shore up its narrative and sort of trying to portray them as some kind of rogue element. But no, they were members of the OPCW. And as Bastani has said, because although he wasn't allowed to speak, the Bensure read out his statement. So in reality, it's on the record. But he's calling for Fernando Arias, the current director general, to air their grievances, you know, and from a public perspective, of course this should happen. You know, something as important as this, which could potentially have taken us to war with Russia, let's not ignore that element in this as well, and in the future can provide justification or the so-called pretext for the destruction of another sovereign nation, right? I mean, we've seen that in Libya. We've seen Libya reduced to a failed state. We've seen Iraq, you know, just plundered and raped and destroyed and destabilized over the 30 years that it's been colonized effectively. Syria, I mean, I live in Syria. I live with the effects of economic sanctions when we talk about the hybrid war strategy, which, of course, is using every method except military. And that's where I'm comparing it to the COVID-19 project. I live in a country that's under absolutely horrendous economic sanctions. Borders are closed under the COVID-19 pandemic pretext. Crops are being burned. I mean, Trump set fire to vast acreages of wheat and barley in the northeast. So alongside plundering oil or using the oil fields as revenue for ISIS and the Kurdish separatist factions, the Kurdish Contras in the northeast. The main reason for occupying the oil fields, of course, is to prevent the Syrians having access to their oil, which means we don't have energy. I don't have electricity. You know, I'm lucky. I have 3 hours on, 3 hours off in the next suburb to me. They only have 2 hours every day. And that's coming into winter, a cold winter. We don't have gas. We regularly don't have fuel because, again, the oil fields are occupied. We only have one operating fuel station in Banyas near Latakia. We effectively have closed borders because America is controlling the borders with Jordan. It's controlling the borders to a large extent with Iraq. Obviously, Turkey's controlling the borders with Turkey. The only country that is capable of providing any sort of economic relief is Lebanon. And there, they've orchestrated an economic collapse and then followed by the Beirut blast. So Lebanon itself is on its knees with inflation, with economic pressures, with devastation. So effectively, you know,
Vanessa, I can see we need to change of policy.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
And do you know what? You see, the problem is we won't get to go too far down this rabbit hole. But I'm a big fan of Trump, and I don't necessarily think it's something that it doesn't really gel with what he's generally a non-interventionist. I mean, I think it's possible that he's been captured by factions within his.
I think my view is that president doesn't actually have the power. I think the difference between Trump and Biden, Trump is a maverick. You know, I'm not a big fan of him in any shape or form, but I think under Trump there was a level of transparency and kind of stability. Here in Syria, for example. I think heading into the Biden administration, we're gazing into the jaws of hell, basically.
What's the opposite of inshallah? How do you say inshallah. May God make it not happen? What's the opposite?
No, I don't think there is an opposite. I think you would just say inshallah it doesn't happen.
What would you say, ma? In what doesn't ma mean? No, ma in no.
La. Inshallah. La.
Okay.
Inshallah. La.
Okay. Yeah. Or mafish inshallah. That's what I was thinking of. Mafish inshallah.
Yeah.
Yeah. La. La Arabic. Inshallah.
Inshallah.
Biden. La inshallah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Listen. What this has made me think is we need to do some more vidcasts because like. This has been like the smorgasbord taster option, where we skitter around and I'll have a bit of smoked fish. I'll have some cheese. And what we need, I think, is to focus because there's loads more I want to ask you about Syria. And I am quite shocked about some of the things that happened. Just very briefly, try and keep it brief because I haven't had my breakfast yet and I'm starving. Although probably starvation is probably the natural state for you in Syria. I'm sorry to hear that. But tell me, the Lebanon, the Beirut explosion, what was that about?
Well, I mean, as far as I know, there's not been any official conclusion from the investigation.
Yeah, but what's the rumor? What's the rumor?
The rumor that, of course, it was. It's probably related to the Syrian situation in the sense that, of course, because in order to make the sanctions on Syria doubly effective or trebly effective, of course, they need to also keep the neighbors or the friendly neighbors or the neighbors that are capable of providing any kind of assistance destabilized. Now, of course, in Lebanese circles, it's considered that probably Israel is behind the explosion. But whoever is behind it, it's very clearly probably part of the campaign to reduce Syria to effectively a failed state. Economically, the economic war is always a war of attrition. It's always actually, in many ways, a harder war to deal with than a military war. But of course, if it follows on from a military war, it's doubly effective because you have areas of the country that are completely devastated by the fighting. You have infrastructure which is severely damaged, unable to operate, like hospitals, like agriculture, like education, etc. All the humanitarian sectors are damaged. And so therefore, there is a need to restore, but then the economic pressures means that restoration is extremely limited. And coming back to Israel, I also need to make the point that Israel has treated the terrorist groups in hospital. All of this is documented in Israeli media. The defense minister has effectively admitted fairly recently that they did supply weapons to Al-Qaeda and to the various armed groups. Israel, of course, tends to bomb whenever there is a military campaign ongoing. For example, in Idlib, when areas of Idlib were liberated, like Sadr Keb, the main arterial road from Aleppo to Damascus was being liberated, Israel started bombing Damascus. You know, this is fairly, and whatever your view on Israel, this is violation of international law. This is unlawful aggression against a sovereign nation without any self-defense pretext.
I think we're going to leave it there.
because otherwise we'll be here for another hour.
Well, my feeling is, if I could, in summary, it's a complete shit show, and there are lots of competing interests doing all manner of things, and actually, I imagine the ordinary people of Syria just want to be left the fuck alone, and to live their life in peace, and you've got the great powers playing the great game. You know, Russia, the West has decided that for historical reasons that Russia is the enemy. So anyone that Russia is friendly with is our enemy. Will you come back on the podcast and talk to me about more things?
Because I would love to.
Because actually, we haven't done the Clinton Foundation, although I've mentioned that. I'll probably be killed before the next show, or you will, or both of us. And we haven't talked about COVID-19. I don't even want to call it that. It sort of dignifies it with a kind of medical, medical integrity it hasn't got. And I also want to talk to you about UK Column, for which...
Yeah. They are amazing. I mean,
you're a member of the gang, aren't you? The UK Column gang,
UK Column gang, I am. I'm proud to be. I mean, they've done an absolutely astounding, solid job of journalism, actually, for a long time now. But on the whole C19, let's call it C19 episode, they've been absolutely at the front, along with Off Guardian, of course. The two of them have done amazing.
We like Off Guardian as well. Yeah, well, I think us, if I may include me in that category, us crazies are really where it's going to be at, because the mainstream media is dead. It's just not doing its fucking job. I mean, it so is not doing its job. Before we go, please will you give a shout out to my sister Hel and her partner or boyfriend? I don't know the word partner, boyfriend, Bear, so happy. They're so happy that I've gone down the rabbit hole, and they'll be so excited that I'm talking to you. So will you say hello to them? Will you wave at them?
Yeah, of course I will. Hi, Hel and Bear. That's a great name.
Yeah.
I take it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right? it is. Well, he looks like a bear. He is a bear. He's a big, puppy friendly bear. But I have to say, we have in the family taken the piss out of them for a long, 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 long time. But all the kind of conspiracy videos they watch and I now realize they're right.
They were absolutely right. On air, James? But they were absolutely right.
I'm not doing chemtrails yet, but maybe who knows. Anyway,
or flat Vanessa, earth. It's... When you reach the flat earth point, you really know that, you know.
Flat earth, good. Vanessa, thank you very much for being on the podcast. May I remind people that I do need support. So if you'd like to help me out, I've got a Patreon page and a Subscribestar page.
Those are my
Patreon. and Vanessa has as well.
Yeah.
What?
I have support as well, Vanessa, a Patreon page. Yeah.
So support both of us, and welcome to all the people who've come to see me for the first time because I'm interviewing Vanessa and previously hated me, and welcome to all the new Vanessa fans. So it's we'll do well out of this, I hope. Thank you, Vanessa. Enjoy your electricity the rest while it lasts for the next hour.
What do you do
by the way when it goes off? You just sort of sit in the sepulchral gloom and shivering.
Well, no, I mean I spend most of my time outside working, talking to people, doing interviews, etc. And you know, if something's happening, I'm traveling to different areas of Syria, so it's fine. But it's a bit of a pain with the whole internet. Laptop dies after 1 hour, and you know,
that's so annoying. Do you spend a lot of time drinking tea and coffee in cafes and smoking with?
Well, I don't smoke. But I mean,
how can you not smoke in the Middle East?
Everyone smokes, don't they? I know. Well, I think I passively probably smoke as much as they do. Like every cafe or bar or taxi you get into is usually chain smoking. And particularly with the stress of the war, it's got a lot worse. But, you know, I would also say to people, if you come to Syria now, and if you come to, like, for example, the old city in Damascus, you would be astounded. If you go there on a Thursday or a Friday night, you would imagine you're in the middle of London.
Is it worth visiting? Should I come to Syria?
Yeah, absolutely. You would love it. Have you never been here?
Do you know what? Before the Civil War, long, you know, inside the 80s, when I was a kind of, you know, backpacker sort of wondering where to go and visit, Syria got a bad rap because the food was apparently bloody disgusting because it was sort of...
The food is delicious! Oh, stop it. Honestly, you really need educating.
Okay. I love Middle Eastern food. I love Middle East, and I know
Syrian food is amazing.
I know it is an honor in your country to give the sheep's eyeball.
Oh God, I'm vegetarian. Don't be.
You're vegetarian. Oh my God.
I'm vegetarian. Just a really quick, very funny story for Hell and Bear is when we were in Deir ez-Zor one time, we were invited to a local sheikh's for lunch. And of course, usually what they would do with honored guests is to kill the sheep. So we're driving to this sheikh's village and he's talking to my translator and he's saying to me, well, they're going to, I was like, no, don't kill them. So he said, well, what does she want to eat? And the only thing I could think of immediately was khabezi. Now, khabezi is basically like chard or spinach. Actually, it's delicious. It's done with garlic and lemon and pomegranate. But the look of horror on this sheikh's face when my translator said to him, no, don't kill the sheep, just make her some khabezi. He was just like, what? You know, this is the food they give on the land. You know, this is not. So anyway, that was just one funny little anecdote of being vegetarian in Syria. But the food here is fantastic. And you are definitely invited to come and visit and to meet the people, talk to them and enjoy the hospitality here.
Okay, thank you, Vanessa. That was great. Well, till next time. Bye-bye.
Yeah. All right. Take care, bye.